Ecclesiastes chapter 11. We are into the last section of the book, the great conclusion of the book, in chapter 11, 7, down through 12, 8. This is really the end of Qohelet's message. The verses from 12, 9 through 12, 14 are sort of an epilogue, a little thing put on the end afterwards, to make a few comments about the preacher and his ministry and his techniques. I suggested to you last week, and I'll review now very briefly, that verses 7 and 8 summarize the point of the book. They consist of a statement about how good life can be, which says that light is sweet in verse 7. At the end of verse 8, there is a statement about how bad life can be. All that comes is vanity. And then in between, there's a statement that combines these two. Now, in our version, it's represented as a single command. If a man live many years and rejoice in them all, yet let him remember the days of darkness. The verb rejoice, though, can also be interpreted as an instruction. And then we would render the verse this way. If a man lives many years, let him rejoice, and let him remember the days of darkness, for they shall be many. And then the whole thing is very nicely arranged. You've got the first half referring to the days of light. Light is sweet. If a man lives many years, let him rejoice in them all. And then the second half dealing with vanity. Let him remember the days of darkness. All is vanity. In both cases, we're told that the rejoicing and the vanity are abundant. A man lives many years, let him rejoice in them all. Let him remember the days of darkness, they shall be many. This is where we've walked with Ecclesiastes, with Qohelet. We've recognized, on the one hand, the darkness of life, many days of darkness, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. This world is full of frustration and despair and disappointment. That's the way it is. To deny that is to be a liar. It's to be untrue to the nature of the world. And the world is that way because of man's sin, because of the fall. At the same time, Qohelet teaches us that we must rejoice in them all. Rejoice in the many years that we live. Not just some of them, but all of them. Not rejoice because of them. The years aren't pleasant. Vanity surrounds us. But we should learn to appreciate the sweetness of light, the joy of seeing the sun, the simple pleasures of being around the dinner table with friends and family. That is the portion that God has given to us. Not some great empire that we build by our own labor and by our own skill, but the simple pleasures of day-to-day life. So this gives us two themes. One is, let him rejoice. The second is, let him remember the days of darkness. And this, in fact, is the outline of the rest of the book, beginning in verse 9. Chapter 11, verse 9, down through 12:1, the first half of 12:1, tell us to rejoice. While beginning in the middle of 12:1 and going down through 12:8 reminds us of the need to remember the days of darkness. So, let him rejoice. That is 11:9 to 12:1a. And let him remember, that's 12:1b to 8. And so we'll begin reading now at chapter 11, verse 9. Rejoice, O young man, in thy youth. And let thy heart cheer thee in the days of thy youth, and walk in the ways of thine heart, and in the sight of thine eyes. But know thou that for all these things God will bring thee into judgment. Therefore remove sorrow from thine heart, and put away evil from thy flesh, for childhood and youth are vanity. Remember now thy Creator in the days of thy youth. Verses 9 and 10 tell us to rejoice, and they do it in two ways. Verse 9 tells us positively to rejoice. Verse 10 tells us to put away sorrow, which is the opposite side of rejoicing. If you're going to rejoice, you've got to put away sorrow. And each of these gives us a reminder not to forget God, not to forget the nature of the world that we live in. First of all, we are to seek joy in verse 9. Rejoice, O young man, in thy youth. The ear is when you're healthy, free from care, you don't have responsibilities to fulfill. What should you do? Let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth, and walk in the ways of your heart and in the sight of your eyes. This is essentially saying, do what you please. Relax. Enjoy yourself. Have a good time. Let your heart and your eyes guide you. Be curious. Explore. Now that by itself might not be good advice because it could lead you into trouble. But Kohelet gives you one little guide here that will keep you out of trouble. It will let you follow your curiosity, follow your interests, explore and enjoy, and never have any problems. And here is that one little magic formula that will protect you from evil. Know thou that for all these things God will bring thee into judgment. Remember that God is going to judge you someday. Remember that He sees everything you do, He sees everything you think, and everything you wish. And someday He's going to judge you. So with that as God's rod and staff guiding you, with that as sort of a fence around your mind, remember that God will judge you. With that, you should feel free to relax and enjoy your youth. Have a good time. You have health, you have freedom, you have independence. Enjoy it. Explore. Rejoice. And at the same time, in verse 10, remove sorrow from thy heart and put away evil from thy flesh. This should be a strong warning to those who think that we should be ascetics. For those who say that we should beat ourselves or abuse our bodies or harm ourselves in some way, either to gain favor with God or to discipline ourselves, make ourselves tough. Put away sorrow. Put away evil from thy flesh. You know, the world is full of unhappiness. Indeed, he reminds us, childhood and youth are vanity. Don't think that you can ever be free of the pains and sorrows of life. You know, let him remember the days of darkness, they shall be many. You can't escape them. But to the extent that you can, don't add extra burdens to yourself. Don't add extra suffering to your life. God will put all the suffering there you need. Don't worry. To the extent you can, remove sorrow from your heart and put away evil from your flesh. That is, mental anguish, sorrow from your heart, physical discomfort, evil from your flesh. You're not more holy if you walk barefoot on nails and wear coarse rags. That doesn't make you more pleasing with God. If you can escape discomfort, do. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 7, if you may be made free, use it rather. But recognize that childhood and youth, like all the rest of life, are vanity. There's going to be some sorrow there, and you won't be able to escape it completely. The summary is 12:1a. Remember now thy Creator in the days of thy youth. That is, as the one who will judge you, and as the one who has placed you in this vain world, and made the creation subject to vanity. Keep him in mind as you rejoice. You see, this is not a rejoicing that forgets God. It's not a rejoicing that takes the place of God. So many of your friends and associates will look for joy as their God. You won't, though. You'll rejoice taking that as God's gift and remembering God and remembering His judgment so that you won't abuse it. You won't abuse the pleasures He gives you. You can rejoice, remembering your Creator in the days of your youth. If a man lives many years, let him rejoice in them all, and let him remember the days of darkness, for they shall be many. And now in the middle of verse 1, we begin to look at the days of darkness. Kohelet outlines three pictures here of the days of darkness. Each of these pictures begins with the words, while not, or as we might say, before. You see in the middle of verse 1, remember now thy Creator in the days of thy youth, while the evil days come not. Or we would say, before the evil days come. And then you'll see it also in verse 2, while, not. Before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars are darkened and the clouds return after the rain. The third occurrence, the same Hebrew words, though slightly different in our English text, appear in verse 6. Before the silver cord is loosed, or the golden bowl is broken, or the pitcher is broken at the fountain, or the wheel broken at the cistern. Rejoice in your youth before these days of darkness pile up on you. And the days of darkness are described with these three statements, each one beginning with before. One in verse 1, one in verse 2, and one in verse 6. So how shall we describe the days of darkness? How shall we describe the vanity that we all must face? First of all, in verse 1, before the evil days come, and the years draw nigh, when thou shalt say, I have no pleasure in them. It's awfully hard for younger people to understand, I think, but you do get old. The time comes when your body deteriorates and it hurts, doesn't work as well as it used to. The American model is you work hard while you're young, and then as you get older, you have lots of money and you can really enjoy life. But the trouble is, you get old and your body's falling apart and you can't enjoy life. Your body deteriorates. Kohelet says, enjoy your youth while you've got it. See, take the blessings God gives you as He gives them to you. When you get old, you may not be able to enjoy life, no matter how wealthy you find yourself to be. The evil days will come, the years will draw nigh when you have no pleasure or purpose. So, He's warning us of the advent of old age. The second before section, verses 2 through 5, describes old age in the form of an eloquent picture. This is a word picture of what it's like to be old. I'll read it through, and then I'll go through it phrase by phrase with you and show you some of these beautiful word pictures that he draws. Before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars are darkened and the clouds return after the rain, in the day when the keepers of the house shall tremble and the strong men shall bow themselves and the grinders cease because they are few and those that look out of the windows be darkened, and the doors shall be shut in the streets when the sound of the grinding is low, and he shall rise up at the voice of the bird, and all the daughters of music shall be brought low. Also when they shall be afraid of that which is high, and fears shall be in the way, and the almond tree shall flourish, and the grasshopper shall be a burden, and desire shall fail, because man goes to his long home, and the mourners go about in the streets. Now how's that for a pile of different words? We've got grasshoppers, we've got almond trees, we've got rain, we've got grinders, we've got windows, we've got doors, we've got birds, we've got music. We even got rhythm, I'll bet. This is quite a conglomeration, isn't it? This is a real Irish stew of word pictures all flitting around together. It's pretty generally agreed that these paint a picture for us of old age, but they're word pictures, they're metaphors. I'll give you one example to start with, and then we'll go back and look at all of them. What about old age do you suppose is being said when he tells us that the grinders cease because they are few? What happens to old people that has to do with grinders becoming few? What do you do your grinding with, Ryan?
You use your teeth.
Use your teeth to grind, don't you? Sure. And when people get old, what happens to their teeth? They often fall out, don't they? Not so much now with modern dentistry. We're doing wonderful things with teeth, but in general, teeth wear out. And they fall out. And once they fall out, they don't meet each other, you know. I mean, if you've got a mouthful of teeth and you've got one tooth here and you've got another tooth there, you don't do a whole lot of chewing with it, do you? And so the grinders cease because they are few. Well, let's go through and look at these pictures one at a time. First picture tells us in verse 2 that the sun and the light and the moon and the stars are darkened. The idea here is that the senses are dulled. Can't see very well, can't feel. In fact, some people say that the sun refers to the spirit, the moon to the soul, and the stars are the five senses. It's an old Jewish interpretation of this phrase. But the general picture is that, you know, maybe your mind isn't quite as fast as it was, your reasoning isn't as good, and your senses aren't as acute. You can't feel things as well. Can't see, you can't hear. Somebody once said, if you want to know what it's like to be old, stick cotton in your ears, smear Vaseline on your eyeglasses, and put on rubber gloves. All right? There you are. That's, everything sort of begins to break down. The nerves just don't work as well as they used to. And the clouds return after the rain. Here in Ann Arbor this summer, we found out how to cure a drought. You just have an art fair, right? Well, you know, in Ann Arbor, you've got sunny days, and occasionally you get a storm, but then as soon as the storm is gone, the sun comes back. So we would say that, you know, the sun comes back after the rain. But when you get old, the clouds return after the rain. It rains and rains and rains. And there's a little pause, but then the clouds come back and it rains again. The clouds and the rain here are a picture of sickness. Young people are generally healthy. Sometimes they get sick. Old people are generally sick. Rarely they may have a good day and they feel good. That's the picture here. The old person, as he gets old, is like a continual rainy day. Always drippy, gloomy. Occasionally the sun shines, but then the clouds come right back again, and there you are. The keepers of the house shall tremble. All the keepers of the house in an ancient household were the people that, you know, the steward that had to bring the food into the house, had to go out in the marketplace and buy it, had to deal with the people around, people that managed the house, the servants who took care of the household. Who are the keepers of the house for our bodies? What are the things that really serve us and bring us the things we need? Well, it's our hands and our arms. And the keepers of the house, when someone gets old, begin to tremble. As the nervous system deteriorates, the hand loses its steadiness, begins to quake. You ever seen an old person's hand, how shaky it can be if they try to hold it out? The keepers of the house tremble. And the strong men shall bow themselves. The strongest muscles in your body are in your legs. And when you get old, the legs get weak. And you tend to walk along sort of crouched, with your knees bent. The strong men bow themselves. The grinders cease because they are few. The teeth are falling out now. And the old person can't chew as well because the teeth don't match. You've got one on top and one on the bottom, but they're on opposite sides of your mouth, and that doesn't do you a whole lot of good. And those that look out of the windows be darkened. What do you think the windows are? It's your eyes. That's right. And you're sort of inside. You're trying to look out of the eyes, trying to look out of the windows, but now the eyesight begins to fail. You can't focus in on things. Maybe you've got cataracts developing, clouding up your vision. Your vision is becoming blurred, and so you can't see as well. And the doors shall be shut in the streets when the sound of the grinding is low. Now, the Hebrew word for doors here is made in a special way, which indicates that he's talking about two doors, not 25 doors. Two doors. So we're talking about some part of a person that has two doors that are shut when the sound of the grinding is low. Because of the grinding going on here, probably he's talking about the lips. And now the doors are shut. They're all stuck in because the teeth are gone. The mouth is all drawn in. You know how the mouth gets puckered in if you don't have teeth? You've seen pictures of people with no teeth, and the mouth is all drawn in. The doors are shut, and the sound of grinding is low. No more do you hear that crisp crunch when you bite into a piece of celery or snap into an apple. Now it's just sort of a dull... as the old person is gumming his food and just sort of mushing it around. The sound of the grinding is low. He shall rise up at the voice of the bird. He's frightened by inconsequential things. A bird sings. Can't hear very well, doesn't know what it is. He thinks that maybe it's a police car coming down the road. Or he thinks that maybe someone's trying to break into the house. And so he's frightened by little sounds, the noise of the birds. He no longer takes pleasure in music. All the daughters of music shall be brought low. Remember Barzillai, the man of Gilead who befriended David when he was exiled from his home when Absalom took over the kingdom? David invited Barzillai to come back to the court with him when he returned to power, but Barzillai said, I'm old. And he listed all the things he couldn't enjoy. One of the things he couldn't enjoy was music. He said, you know, I can't take pleasure anymore in singing men and singing women. Again, because the senses are deteriorated and the noise bothered him more than the music brought him pleasure. Also, when they shall be afraid of that which is high. Now, there is a standard paradigm, which is that boys climb trees and mothers stand back in terror. Come down from there, you'll fall and break every bone in your body. Well, what the mother is really reflecting is her own fear of climbing up in the tree. If you have a grandmother around, you're even in worse shape. because they're even more afraid of falling. People get old and the bones get brittle. You know, a young person can fall and they bounce. Boing, you played basketball with them. But the old people, when they fall, bones tend to break. Old people know this, and so they're very, very cautious. An old person won't even climb up the stairs if they can help it. They're afraid of heights because they're afraid of falling. Their balance isn't so sure, and they're afraid they'll break something. And fears shall be in the way. We would say fears shall be in the road. The way is the road. They're afraid of going on trips. Old people don't like change. They don't like new environments. They want to stay where everything is familiar. Sometimes it's because of the frequent sicknesses that they're subject to, the clouds that come back after the rain. They don't want to be caught away from home when the next bout of sickness comes on them. So they prefer to stay put. I'm sure those of us who have older parents, you know, it gets harder and harder for them to come visit us as time goes by just because the trip becomes more and more of a burden. Fear shall be in the way. The almond tree shall flourish. Now, what do almond trees have to do with all this? Well, just this, that in spring, the almond tree in Israel is covered with white blossoms, pinkish white blossoms. Completely covered. The tree is a solid mass of pinkish white that turns to white as the blossoms mature, and then they all fall off. And the ground is carpeted with white all around the tree. It's a very dramatic flowering. You can see the almond trees as you ride the train through the countryside in the springtime. Here's this green countryside with this blaze of white blossoms, the almond tree. Well, the picture here is of a person's hair, you see, turning white, turning gray with age, and then eventually falling out, growing thin. The almond tree flourishing sounds nice, but it's actually a picture of deterioration. The grasshopper shall be a burden. This is a very obscure line, but probably refers to the picture of an old man sort of going along like this with his arms behind him to balance, crouched over. And if you use your imagination, this sort of looks like a grasshopper, you know, with the way the hind legs are bent back and come out in the front. It's referring to the crouched over gait of an old man, like a slow grasshopper. And desire shall fail. The physical appetites deteriorate. Food is no longer appealing. One of the hardest things with an old person is to get them to eat. They no longer have any appetite. Because man goes to his long home. Long here is used in the sense of time. The Hebrew word means eternal. Man goes to his eternal home. This world here is only a temporary dwelling. We're not going to be here forever. We must one day leave it for a more permanent abode. Now, Kohelet does not have a good picture of what that permanent abode is. He doesn't have the full light of New Testament revelation on this subject. But he does know that we don't stay here forever. The point is that one day we shall pass from this life into another. We shall pass into our eternal home. And so he says, the mourners go about the streets. You have to understand that in Old Testament society, when someone died, you hired mourners to help you wail. They were professional mourners. That was one of the professional roles within the society. And so when somebody in a house was getting close to the end, professional mourners who caught wind of this would see to it that they were in the neighborhood waiting so that when the time came, the other members of the family would find them there. I mean, after all, if there are 25 mourners in town and they're only going to hire five at a time, you want to be the one that gets hired. So, sort of like the vultures, you know, waiting for the man to drop in the desert. The mourners are waiting around in the streets, just twiddling their thumbs, waiting for this guy to pass away so that they can be hired to do the mourning for the funeral. Sounds rather gruesome, but that's his whole point, folks. This is what you're headed for. All of us. We're all going to die. Can't escape it. Let him remember the days of darkness, for they shall be many. This is what's waiting for you. The days of darkness, the time of death. Finally, in verse 6, we have some more pictures of death itself. Three pictures in particular. The first picture is the silver cord being loosed and the golden bowl broken. Now, those of you who've been out in our porch know that we have baskets with spider plants hanging around the porch. Apparently, hanging things have long been a favorite way to decorate houses, because the picture here is that you've got some kind of a beautiful golden bowl hanging from the ceiling. Maybe there are flowers in it. Maybe it's got incense burning in it. Maybe it's just hanging because it's a beautiful work of art. Maybe it's a lamp that's hanging up there. And because it's made of gold, you wouldn't want to hang it with string, so you hang it up with a silver wire. And it's beautiful, it brings pleasure to everybody, but then one day the cord is broken and the bowl comes clashing down to the stone floor where it's bent and broken into pieces, and now it's nothing but a pile of crooked metal. That's one picture of death. Life is nice as long as it lasts, but someday the cord breaks and the bowl comes crashing down, and that which is beautiful and lovely becomes ugly. Or again, the pitcher is broken at the fountain, or the wheel broken at the cistern. Well, here we have a well. Now, you know what wells look like. You've got a framework around the well, and up at the top, you've got this cylinder here, or a wheel of some sort, with a rope wrapped around it that holds the bucket, which is here called the pitcher, and you lower the pitcher into the well. Now, a lot of wells in the Holy Land don't work this way. They don't have the wheel. A lot of them, you just pull the rope over the edge, but there's some evidence that some ancient wells had wheels on them, some of the real super fancy ones. And the picture here is that this all works well while it works. This is a great mechanism. You turn the handle and up comes your water. It's almost as nice as turning on the faucet. But what happens if these supports rot away and this cylinder is broken? There's nothing to hold the rope anymore, and the pitcher goes crashing down into the cistern and is broken. And so again, there's a picture here of something that is functional and beautiful while it lasts, but someday it's broken and it's over. You are like a well. Everything works well as long as it works. But when one piece breaks, the whole thing is finished. It's all done. And then most directly of all, verse 7, "Then shall the dust return to the earth as it was, and the spirit shall return unto God who gave it." Here we come the closest to a direct citation of the curse, when God said to Adam, "You are made of dust, dust thou art, and unto dust shalt thou return." We know that God made man of the dust of the earth, and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul. Well, here the time comes when man returns to dust, and that spirit of God, that breath of God, goes back to him. And after this, Mr. Preacher says, "Vanity of vanities, all is vanity." Now, that's how we started this book. Chapter 1, verse 2. "Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity." That's where he started. That's the point he wants us to learn. And that's now where he leaves us. I like what one commentator says about this. "The author has now reached the close. He has made all earthly things small, and at last remain seated on this dust heap of all is vanity." The motto-like saying is repeated here as a QED, like a summary conclusion. Do you know what QED is? In a mathematical proof, the way a mathematical proof or a theorem is structured, you start off and you say, "Theorem. Some statement. Here is something that I claim to be true." And then you give your arguments for it. "Well, this is this, and this is this, and this is so and so." Until finally, let's call this ABC. Finally, you come down and you say, "Therefore, ABC." And then you say QED. QED means quod erat demonstrandum, which is a Latin phrase that means that which was to be demonstrated. The last line in a proof is always the same as the first line. And when you've reasoned yourself down to here, you say, "This is what I had set out in the first place to prove, and there it is, I'm done. I have proved my point." That's exactly what he's doing here. The whole book can be viewed as a theorem, where he starts off at the beginning with his thesis. "Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity." And then he goes on through the entire book, analyzing every aspect of life until he comes to the end. And then he says once more, "Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. I showed you that. I proved it. I'm done." Folds his hands. And so, "If a man live many years, let him rejoice in them all, but let him remember the days of darkness, for they shall be many." See, the point of the book is enjoy life and expect sorrow. enjoy life and expect sorrow. The world is fallen. It's going to be painful to live in it. But enjoy it. God will give you pleasure. Small pleasures. Things that the rest of the world may consider insignificant, but you can count on them. They're yours. Enjoy them. Now, with verse 9, we enter the epilogue. Whether it's written by the preacher or not is not clear. Could have been added by whoever compiled his sayings. It talks about the preacher. Moreover, because the preacher was wise, he still taught the people knowledge. Yea, he gave good heed and sought out and set in order many proverbs. The preacher sought to find out acceptable words, and that which was written was upright, even words of truth. The words of the wise are as goads and as nails fastened by the masters of assemblies, which are given from one shepherd. And further by these, my son, be admonished. Of making of many books there is no end, and much study is a weariness of the flesh. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God shall bring every work into judgment with every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. I know that all the boys, and maybe all the girls too, have at one time or another dropped a stone into a pond. You drop a stone into a pond, you get the place where the stone goes in, and then you see the ripples spreading out around it. Well, this last section is sort of like viewing the book of Ecclesiastes as a stone that's dropped in a pond. At the very center, we talk about the preacher's teaching, which we have just read. So we'll put a Q in here for Kohelet. And then we come out and we talk about the teaching of wise men in general. He sort of generalizes from what Kohelet has taught to the work of wise men in general. And then he goes out one step further and he derives, I'll put a P for principle, a general principle which characterizes all that the wise men teach. It's increasing generalization and abstraction from what Kohelet does. We'll start on this. We'll see how far we get with it. Let's begin with the description of Kohelet's teaching in verses 9 and 10. Verse 9 tells us, first of all, that the preacher was wise. That seems like a casual place to start, but it's an important place to start. You can't take people beyond where you are yourself. You wouldn't want a preacher who was a fool. It's important for us to understand that the preacher was himself a wise man. And we've seen that wisdom is more than gray matter, though it includes that. It's a word like righteous. It has an ethical dimension to it, a moral dimension. A wise person is a person who is righteous. So he was wise. He went beyond that. He taught the people knowledge. He did not keep his wisdom to himself. He taught it to the people. And now we're told something about the form of his teaching and also the content of his teaching. The form of his teaching is outlined in verse 9. He gave good heed and sought out and set in order many proverbs. The form of his teaching had to do with proverbs. Now, a proverb is a very special kind of teaching. If you look at Proverbs 26, verse 7, you'll see a standard for proverbs. Another word for proverb is parable. Well, you realize that those are same idea in the Old Testament. Proverbs 26, verse 7. The legs of the lame are not equal. So is a parable in the mouth of fools. The basic notion of a proverb or parable is that of comparison. It's comparing two things, one to another. Sometimes the comparison is just in the form of poetic parallelism. Sometimes it's taking an event in real life and comparing it to a spiritual teaching. But it's important that the two sides of the parable correspond to one another, or the proverb. They have to balance. They have to be equal. Otherwise, the point is lost. You can see that in this parable that we were looking at, Proverbs 26, verse 7. The legs of the lame are not equal, so is a parable in the mouth of fools. A lame man's legs are of different length. And a foolish man's parable or proverb doesn't match up either. The two halves don't balance. But right here you have an example of that. He's comparing the legs of the lame to a parable. And the point of the comparison is that there are two pieces which have to match for it to work. if the two pieces don't match, it doesn't work. Now that's tricky, to get Proverbs to work that way. If I were to give you a proverb that said something like, good Bible study is like the dust under the living room rug. That's a statement. It's a comparison. But what similarity is there between good Bible study and the dust under the living room rug? You have to be pretty clever to find one. Now, I'm sure after the meeting, someone will come up to me and say, well, I figured one out for you. There is a good comparison between dust under the living room rug and good Bible study.
They both cover everything.
But the comparisons tend to be weak. It takes a lot of doing to find a good parable. So, what does Mr. Preacher do? Well, first of all, it says he gave good heed. That means he pondered. He weighed. Whenever a parable occurred to him or a proverb, he thought about it. He decided, is this really a decent parable or is it not a good one? Maybe it just isn't going to teach. It's not going to work. And so it tells us that he threw a lot of stuff out. He evaluated every candidate for inclusion in his collection, and a lot of them he threw out. He didn't stop there. He also sought out proverbs. He wasn't content with the ones he already knew to evaluate them. He also looked for others. He gave diligent attention to trying to find new ones, asking around and collecting other insights that could enrich the teaching that he had to present. And then he set them in order. There are many proverbs in the book of Ecclesiastes, and the order in which they come is important. We've seen groupings of thought. We've seen sections of ideas that talk about the king, that talk about wisdom and folly and labor. The whole is more than the sum of the parts. By bringing these pieces together, he's given us something that's well constructed. But it's not just the form of his teaching that's important. Verse 10 tells us what the content of his teaching was. The preacher sought to find out acceptable words, and that which was written was upright, even words of truth. So there are three standards for what he taught. They were acceptable, upright, and true. Now, there are two possible meanings for the word that's here translated acceptable. It might mean pleasant. The preacher sought to find out pleasant words, and then that would tell us that he's trying to put a sugar coating around everything that he's saying. But there's another meaning for the word that is very, very common in Ecclesiastes, and I think it's the meaning that's used here. That is the meaning purpose, purposeful. The preacher sought to find out purposeful words. That is, he did not just talk to hear himself talk. He didn't just write to fill books. When he had something to say, there was a purpose to it. He was grappling with the real problems. He was getting down to brass tacks, we would say. And the same idea is conveyed in the phrase, that which was written was upright. Right or straight is the idea here. It was straight talk. He didn't circumvent the issue. He went right to the heart of the matter. Finally, it was true. His words were words of truth. They corresponded with God's word. They met the standards of accuracy and honesty. Now, this is how the preacher directed himself. You'll notice that his work consists of both the form and the content of what he teaches. He gives energy to be sure that the content is practical, purposeful, and accurate, truthful. And he also gives attention to the form of it, to make good proverbs, to evaluate carefully what he's going to say, to weed out that which is not profitable, and to include that which is profitable and will be helpful to people. And all that is here at the center. That's the stone dropped into the pond that we have been studying. I think I'll stop here. Next week, Lord willing, what I'd like to do is look at the words of the wise, and then finally the conclusion to the whole thing. And then we'll walk through the entire book of Proverbs, of Ecclesiastes, rather. And we'll try to put together some of the major sections of the book. It doesn't have real clear structure, but I think there are some main currents or themes that go through it. We'll try to walk through those so that we can have the whole book in our mind as we conclude our study on it.